will speak next, and will be followed by Bill Shirk, and then the schedule will be back as printed. John Hesse is curator of American music here at the National Museum of American History, and is the editor of Ragtime, Its History, Composers, and Music, published by Macmillan in 1985. With Ronald Rodano, John Hesse is producing a four-record album, the classic Hoagie Carmichael, to be published next March. I'd like to welcome John Hesse to the podium.
Thank you, Richard. And good morning, everybody. My talk this morning is on Hoagie Carmichael as recording artist. And I think it's very appropriate that we're having this meeting in Carmichael Auditorium. The Smithsonian, I guess, thinks this is named for Leonard Carmichael, a former head of the Smithsonian, but of course we music people have some other ideas. I'd like to, on behalf of the museum, invite you, as before, to see the Nation of Nations exhibit, which is on the second floor, one floor up. There are also a couple of other exhibitions you might be interested in seeing while you're here in the museum. Around the corner, next to Engines of Change, there are a number of early recording playback devices. And there's also a Hall of Electricity, which is a related subject in terms of hardware. On third floor, we have the Hall of Musical Instruments, and there is a video presentation on the history of the piano, which includes various recorded examples. Before we get into the subject matter proper, I'd first like to briefly review Carmichael's life. It falls into three periods. He was born in 1899 in Bloomington, Indiana, and spent about the next 30 years primarily in Indiana in the Midwest. He studied piano with his mother and a black pianist in Indianapolis named Reginald Duval, and attended Indiana University, formed a campus jazz band, befriended Bix Beiderbecke. They became fast friends, and Bix recorded his Hoagie's first song, Riverboat Shuffle. And in 1927, Hoagie came up with a song which his friends suggested be called Stardust. And this, of course, launched Carmichael's career. Originally, it was somewhat up-tempo and kind of, well, a little bit raggy, quite different than the typical ballad version we're familiar with today. And I'd like to play as my first example on your handout a bit of the 1927 recording of Stardust, recorded in Richmond, Indiana for Jeanette Records. Years later, words were added to the song. It was published by Mills Music in New York City at about the time Hoagie himself was moving to New York, heeding the siren song of the Big Apple. He was there for about 6 or 7 years until 1936, and it was in New York that he teamed up with people such as Louis Armstrong and Beiderbecke again, and the Dorsey Brothers, Joe Venuti, Mildred Bailey, Benny Goodman, people like that, recording with some of the top jazz people of the day. He continued to write songs, had a major success commercially with Lazy Bones, teamed up with Johnny Mercer on a lot of songs. In 1936, he moved permanently to Hollywood, where, as he put it, the rainbow hits the ground for composers. He worked with Frank Lesser, Paul Francis Webster, a number of other lyricists, and became active in motion pictures, on radio, eventually on television, and stepped up his career as a recording artist. In 1981, at the age of 82, Carmichael died a few days after Christmas at his home near Palm Springs, California. A couple of years ago, the Carmichael family decided it needed a home for Carmichael's music and recordings, And so they sought out Indiana University, and they've donated practically his entire archive and library to the Indiana University Archives of Traditional Music, and where it forms the Hoagy Carmichael Collection in the Hoagy Carmichael Room. There's a lot of great stuff there, which we have been drawing on for our recording project. Let's first look at the question of record affiliations in Hoagy Carmichael's career as a recording artist. As Table 1 in your handout indicates, that's page 2, Carmichael moved around periodically. Other than a complete four-year hiatus in his recordings as leader or sideman between 1934 and 1938, Carmichael recorded just about every year between 1925 and 1956. His peak year of recordings were between 1945 and 1950, and his chief labels were Decca, Victor, ARA, and Jeanette. As far as credits or billing is concerned, most of the recordings on which Carmichael performed before 1930 were as a sideman. After 1930, they were almost exclusively as a leader. He occasionally sang guest vocals, as with Glenn Gray and the Casa Loma Orchestra, or with Paul Whiteman's orchestra, or shared billing, as on a few recordings with Cass Daly. But primarily, he was the named leader of the sessions. What kind of repertory did Carmichael record? Most of his recordings were of his own compositions. As the creator of the music and the lyric settings, and sometimes creator of the lyrics themselves, Carmichael was, after all, uniquely positioned to interpret his songs. It's safe to say that he recorded most of his compositions, and nearly all of the songs which are remembered of his compositions, even including the rather difficult-to-sing pieces such as Skylark. Carmichael did not, however, record all his songs. For example, Moonburn was one he never recorded. The pieces he recorded but did not compose are primarily independent popular songs. None are from Broadway shows, and few, if any, are from Hollywood movies. They range from old ragtime-flavored songs like Walkin' the Dog, vaudeville blues like, or vaudeville-type blues like St. Louis Gal, standard or eventual standard pop tunes such as Am I Blue and Sweet Lorraine, comic songs like Barnacle Bill the Sailor and Huggin' and Chalkin', throwback pieces like Darktown Strutter's Ball, the old piano roll blues, and That's a Plenty, even the country and western number I Walk the Line. Many of these pieces shared the common attributes of simplicity, lack of artifice and adornment, and accessibility. By selecting earlier pieces in many cases, Carmichael confirmed an attitude of longing for the past that is evident in some of his own compositions and their lyrics. There's also a cheerful and good-humored attitude that comes through sometimes in the Carmichael selections, such as in Huggin' and a Chalkin', in fact, downright broad humor. As Table 2 in your handout demonstrates, throughout his recording career, Carmichael returned frequently to the same songs, especially his own Stardust, Rockin' Chair, Washboard Blues, Lazy River, and Hong Kong Blues, each with at least four recordings. He was probably exploiting their existing familiarity and durability and trying to further popularize and perpetuate them. In some instances, he evidently evolved new interpretations and wanted to put them before the public. Because he recorded several dozen songs more than once, there exists an opportunity for someone to study how these multiple performances are alike and different, and the effect of different variables. For example, how did his seven or eight recordings of Stardust, spanning more than 30 years, differ? What differences in recordings of the same song can be attributed to Carmichael's varying accompaniment, to the arrangements, to the unseen A&R men at the various record labels? What can be said about recordings of the same song which were done not a year or two apart, but 10 or 20 or 40 years apart, perhaps as conscious revivals? At a time when, for example, eight different artists recorded Old Buttermilk Sky within a few months of each other, how did Carmichael's own interpretation stand up? What about cover recordings made by Carmichael himself, those instances when he recorded the same song for different labels within a short span? Most of these, by the way, self-covers, occurred in the mid-1940s during a time when he was recording prolifically for Decca, ARA, and the non-commercial V-Disc. I used to think that Carmichael had a terrible singing voice. I was distracted by his Hoosier flatness in much of the singing, and turned off especially by his uncertain intonation. But with repeated listenings, I grew accustomed to these traits and grew to appreciate and admire other qualities of his vocal performances, specifically charm, sincerity, humor, inventiveness, sometimes even sheer audacity. A slight digression here on the question of intonation. The aesthetic importance placed upon precise intonation is something which Americans have imported from European art music. European folk music does not necessarily have the same emphasis, and West African music has an entirely different concept of intonation. There, the concept is of many shades of, quote, correct intonation, even micro-intonation. This alternative approach to intonation has come down to American music through Afro-American music with its blues tonality and microtonalism. There is no question that Carmichael's intonation was far less precise than many of his contemporaries. It seems to me that there are two plausible explanations for this. First, possibly he was trying to match European art music standards of intonation, but simply couldn't cut it. Or second, possibly Carmichael had the Afro-American approach to intonation in mind, because he was steeped in blues and black music. He grew up a couple blocks from a black section of Bloomington, which was known then as Bucktown. And he loved the music that he heard growing up. He studied with a black pianist in Indianapolis. He went to the Red Light District and hung out there. He absorbed a lot of black music live as a student, as a listener of records. It's possible that he had this intonation approach in mind, either consciously or unconsciously, or possibly it was a combination of both of these factors. As a singer, Carmichael was fundamentally a crooner. By this I mean that his voice was one which was highly dependent upon the microphone, whether in a recording studio, a radio station, or on the occasional theater stage before an audience. Carmichael's recordings, like his compositions themselves, were truly microphone songs. It is an interesting coincidence that Carmichael made his first records at the very time that electrical recordings were becoming standard. Carmichael's success as a recording artist relied greatly on the fate of the microphone, electrical sound amplification, and of electrical sound recording. His success as a songwriter was also dependent upon these same technologies, since he wrote for amplified microphones, not for the stage. In some of the early recordings, Carmichael sounds as if he is taking himself rather too seriously, and I'd like to play a brief excerpt from Lazy River, which is example 2 on the first page of your handout.
Of the lazy river by the old mill bend, that lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun, lingering in the shade of a kind old tree, roll away your troubles, dream a dream with me. Of the lazy river where the robin's song awakes the bright new morning, you can look along. Blue skies up above, everyone's in love. Up that lazy river, how happy you can be. Up that lazy river with me.
In later recordings, there is frequently an offhand casualness. And to demonstrate this, I'd like to play example 3, which is from Old Buttermilk Sky, recorded in mid-1946 for ARA. However, the offhand casualness, I think, is really deceptive. Carmichael may not have taken himself so seriously, but he evidently took his material and the recording sessions seriously. One can attest to this by listening to an unissued dub of a recording session, which is probably from the 1960s, in which Carmichael tries again and again to perfect an introduction and keeps making a mistake every time and keeps uttering curses. This recording is out at Indiana University. Though Carmichael may have sounded untutored as a singer, he was not unpracticed nor undisciplined. His early singing sounds quite serious most of the time, with a bit of southern Indiana Anglo-American hill country tightness, the kind of vocal tightness you hear, for example, in traditional Anglo-American ballad singing. This reflects Carmichael's cultural background, for culturally, southern Indiana, where he grew up, is much more a part of the southern uplands, Kentucky and Tennessee hill country, than the north. And the southern uplands is where this type of singing has survived the longest. Later, Carmichael loosened up and sounded more natural in terms of the crooning style. And here I'd like to play you a couple more examples. The next one, example four on your handout, is Hong Kong Blues from 1942. This was the second time he recorded it, and this was the version that was best known to the public and rather a commercial success. Let's listen to this piece in its entirety. I think that's a wonderful recording interpretation. Carmichael at his natural and humorous and ironic best, he really exploits his range, which was rather large. I don't think Frank Sinatra could have sung that song, at least in recent years. It's a very difficult song to sing, as a matter of fact, and while a number of other people have tried it, to my mind, no one else has succeeded. It's one of those individually Carmichael compositions and interpretations. I also think that in that song you hear the uncertain intonation used to Carmichael's advantage, because he's trying to do some oriental effects. Interestingly enough, the ethnically stereotyped lyrics have in later years been changed. It's now an unfortunate Memphis man, and the reference to cocaine has been dropped. Opium, I'm sorry. Right. The next example is from the same recording date. This is Stardust with the same piano and bass accompaniment, and Carmichael both sings and plays the piano here. Carmichael did that song a lot, of course, and I think that's perhaps his best vocal interpretation. So fresh and natural, even though it had been around for 15 years, and at that point it had been recorded, I believe, several hundred times. He makes the song sound fresh and very believable. It's a uniquely Carmichael interpretation, his bold whistling coming in there, and again he demonstrates a pretty substantial range, because that song is quite difficult to sing. It's not a song that fits naturally with the human voice. It's very much an instrumental line. Moving right along to the next example, example 6 on your handout, I'd like to play a unissued recording owned by Indiana University. This is a piece that Carmichael wrote in 1959 called Serenade to Gabriel, and playing this to demonstrate the emotional impact that Carmichael could have. If you can visualize him late in his life, looking back on his many friends who have passed on, Bix Beiderbecke, Glenn Miller, and so many other people, and reminiscing and looking ahead to the end of his own life, really acting the song out in a very convincing manner.
Yeah.
As a pianist, Carmichael is normally heard on record in the role of accompanist, either to a band or his own singing. On these recordings, he sometimes takes a short piano solo. In a few instances, he recorded an entire piano solo, notably a few sides for Victor in 1933, and in 1945, he recorded a piano solo of Stardust for V-Disc. My next example is from one of those Victor sessions in 33. This is Stardust as a piano solo. And for those of you who know the original 1927 Jeanette recording of Stardust, you'll hear some of that same solo in this piece. I find that a very interesting performance for its mixture of approaches and styles, and I think you hear a number of elements in there from Carmichael's background in ragtime and jazz. There's some parlor piano in there. There's a little bit of novelty piano influence in the latter part of that improvisation. Carmichael's piano style did take a lot from the ragtime and jazz of his youth. So rooted in the 1920s was it that in the late 40s, when he played opposite a Bix Beiderbecke-ian character played by Kirk Douglas in Young Man with a Horn, Hoagie's piano playing was dubbed in by Buddy Cole, who had a more modern, fluid sound. By this time, Carmichael's own piano playing style sounded nostalgic, and It was perfectly suited to a couple of honky-tonk recordings he made in the early 1950s. I don't know about the history of whistling on record. There are no entries for whistling in any of the three Grove dictionaries of music. But when and if this story is written, Carmichael certainly ought to deserve at least a footnote. He whistled on quite a few recordings, actually, and sometimes his whistling worked, as on the Stardust we've just heard, and in Francis Langford's, we heard a couple numbers ago, rather, and in Francis Langford's memorable rendition of Baltimore Oriole, both Decca, 1942. Sometimes his whistling did not work on the next number I'd like to play for you, which is also Decca from 1942. One might expect whistling to be an unwelcome intrusion into the musical sonorities, but usually it sounds perfectly natural for Carmichael to do it. This is Don't Forget to Say No, Baby, a World War II period piece that I think still has a lot of charm today, from 1942. I think that's an inspired bit of scat singing in there and a marvelous performance overall. Incidentally, the drummer and the bassist on the three Decca dates from May 11th, 1942 are Spike Jones and Artie Bernstein. One of Carmichael's traits as a recording artist was, over the long term, his versatility. During the course of his career, he recorded with top jazzmen, with dance bands, with movie singers, with country and western singers, in honky-tonk sing-along settings, with symphony orchestras, with children in a children's songbook, even with a rock and roller, Maria Muldaur. After the early 1930s, in some ways, his recording persona defied categorization. While there may have been a conscious effort on the part of Carmichael, or at least his A&R men, to break into additional record submarkets, in the end, I suspect that the variety of his musical settings, accompanists, and singing partners had more to do with his versatility and acceptance in many segments of the record industry and populace than with anything else. As a recording artist, Carmichael enjoyed modest success from the early 30s through the early 50s. According to figures compiled by Joel Whitburn, Table 3 in your handout, Carmichael had 9 songs which reached into the top 25 of the record charts or in their equivalent. This list did not include any of his recordings of Stardust, interestingly enough. Of these nine, quote, recordings, six were composed by Carmichael and the last three written by other songwriters. In terms of the hit parade, 1946 was a banner year for Carmichael, with three songs in the charts, one of them a number one hit and another reaching number two in the charts. Soon afterwards, the Jukebox Operators of America reportedly voted Carmichael Artist of the Year. In addition to the several hundred disc recordings which preserve Carmichael's performances, about 30 performances of his are preserved in motion pictures. These are listed in Table 4 of your handout. Beginning in 1937 and picking up steam in the mid-1940s, Carmichael's screen career added a visual dimension to his recording and songwriting careers. Since he did not tour in vaudeville or variety, Carmichael was known almost exclusively by his name on sheet music and his voice on discs, up until the time he got into pictures. With his films, he became a living, breathing, singing, piano-playing, talking, and feeling person. His first few appearances on movies were decidedly in the way of bit parts, limited to musical numbers only, but eventually he became a musical and dramatic presence on screen. Let's watch two numbers from Carmichael's films, and Jeannie, if we could have the stage lights off, please. The first is from the 1937 motion picture Topper, in which Carmichael has one brief scene with Cary Grant and Constance Bennett, who have been bar hopping and at this very moment are rather soused. The proprietor of the bistro where Carmichael plays is impatiently trying to close down the establishment for the evening. Young and somewhat self-conscious here, Hoagie is playing himself. In fact, both the proprietor and Cary Grant refer to him as Hoagie. And at the end of the scene, you'll see Cary Grant say goodbye. The song here is a little-known Carmichael number called Old Man Moon. Yeah, thank you. Role as a singer, songwriter, instrumentalist for a younger generation of musicians to be. Among singer, songwriter, pianists, Carole King, Elton John, Billy Joel, Neil Sedaka, and Dave Frischberg come immediately to mind. And of course, there were dozens of singer, songwriter, guitarists who came to prominence in the 1960s. Although there were, of course, singer-songwriters centuries before Carmichael, he was one of the first in the age of mass media. Carmichael and his music played a role in the first decade of electrical sound recording, in the first decade of sound movies, in the first decade of network television, and in the heyday of radio. He was extensively heard and seen through these media, and his likeness disseminated through extensive sheet music publications, as well as personal appearances and coverage by the popular press. Carmichael was a household name, his music part of the accompaniment to daily living for millions of people. And of course, he's one of those relatively few Americans who's immediately identifiable by his first name alone. It is likely that Carmichael set an example of a songwriter who could not only perform in his own very personal style, have frequent opportunities to perform his own material, maintain considerable artistic control as composer and performer over his recordings, be uniquely positioned to exploit or promote his compositions, achieve success in terms of popularity and financial rewards, and also become an international celebrity. If post-1950 pop music had largely continued the previous era's pattern of the songsmiths writing the songs for a separate group of singers to perform, the course of our recent popular music history might be quite different than it has been. Thank you.
We might have time for one or two questions, and then John has to go off to catch a plane.
What label is this Hoagie Carmichael album going to be on? That Ronald Rodano is back there on the aisle side, and I are working on together with the assistance of a number of people here in the Smithsonian, like Martin Williams and Margaret Robinson and quite a few others. It's going to be issued by the Indiana Historical Society possibly co-published by the Smithsonian Institution Press. That's not certain yet. Yes.
I find it very interesting, anything you might know about which of the